Hi, guys. Welcome to New Books in Public Policy. This is Sean Hamilton, your host. Our guest today is Paul Barrett, the author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Paul, welcome.
Glad to be here. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for joining us. I guess first, tell us about your background and how you came to write the book.
Sure. Well, I've been a journalist for, close to 30 years now. I've followed the gun industry since the late 1990s when I began at the Wall Street Journal to follow litigation against the gun industry that was brought by cities and counties all across the country that were imitating the states that had earlier sued the tobacco industry. So these lawsuits very much fascinated me, and I wrote about them at some length for the Journal. And then I got interested in the gun industry itself, realized that it really was a unique industry, uniquely wound up with American history, law, politics, culture. And I like to say that you never meet a boring person who works in the gun industry. Everybody's got a story. Everybody has some fascinating, sometimes slightly kooky experiences. And, to me, it's a never-ending source of interesting anecdotes and statistics and so forth. So some years went by. I wrote about other things, wrote books on some other subjects. And in 2009, an old source of mine who was a senior executive with Glock called me up out of the blue and said, you've always been bugging me to tell you more details about how Glock, which everyone knows is a very important firearm manufacturer, you wanted to know the inner workings. And I said, absolutely. And he said, well, now I'm ready to tell you. And this began a process whereby this longtime executive, who at that point was a former executive, he'd had a falling out with the founder of the company, Gaston Glock. He provided me with a lot of fascinating inside information. I did a series of magazine articles based on that information, having moved at that point to Business Week magazine. And that work suggested to me that the story of Glock, the story of this one particular handgun, would actually tell the larger story of the gun market in the United States and even more broadly the American fascination with firearms in the latter part of the 20th century and early 21st century. So that's when I realized, you know what, there's really a book in this, and I'm going to write basically a biography of a gun, tell the story of the Glock, and that's what led to the book.
Okay. Now, you open the book with a story about a shootout in Miami.
Right.
That, tell that story, just to kind of set the stage for the...
Sure thing. This is the famous FBI Miami shootout that took place in 1986, and it really made an impression on law enforcement at all levels in this country. A group of FBI agents on a stakeout, what they call a rolling stakeout, where they're following suspects in cars, encountered two. In this case, it wasn't the characteristic drug dealers who were the criminals causing so much violence at the time. These two guys were actually bank robbers, old-fashioned bank robbers, but they were very, very heavily armed. And the FBI suffered a number of casualties, and coming out of this this very gruesome, lurid shootout, the FBI declared that it needed to find a new handgun to replace the traditional Smith & Wesson 5 or 6 shot revolver that it had armed its agents with for literally for generations. And at the same time, large municipal police departments all across the country were encountering rising gun violence, and they said, you know, we need to do this too. We need a new firearm. And right at that moment, although entirely by coincidence, Gaston Glock was arriving in this country and saying, I have the pistol of the future. The Glock, which he had invented in the early 1980s and sold to the Austrian military. And it had a number of features that really appealed to the American cops as they had to the Austrian Ministry of Defense before them. And that's really the story of how Gaston Glock, this obscure Austrian engineer, got his foot in the door here in the United States.
And now, talk a little bit about the process by which Glock came to, or Gaston Glock came to invent the gun itself. That was pretty interesting.
very unusual story. This is not a guy who was deeply steeped in the gun industry. He didn't even own firearms. He ran a radiator factory outside Vienna, was kind of a pedestrian engineer and plant manager. He did also run a small home-based business in his garage where he operated a secondhand Soviet-built metal press with his wife, Helga. And they made things like brass window fittings and steel knife blades. Well, the knife blades, they eventually sold some of those to the Austrian military as for field knives and bayonets. And that brought him into touch with military officials in his home country. And he learned in 1980 that the Austrian army was going to be replacing its World War II era pistols, which were falling apart. And in a very unlikely gesture, he put his hand up and said, "I'd like to volunteer to design the new pistol." And people literally in the military laughed at him. "Who are you? You make knife blades in your garage at home. You don't have a factory. You don't know anything about guns." But every now and then you have one of these strange incidents where someone with some ambition and possibly a lack of inhibition makes an opportunity for themselves. And that's what happened with Gaston Glock. He knew he didn't know anything about guns, so he gathered several European handgun experts, asked them for their best ideas of what they would make if they had the opportunity to start from scratch with a brand new firearm, and those ideas became the first version of the Glock, the so-called Glock 17, named the Glock 17 because it was the 17th patent that Gaston Glock had acquired in his theretofore quite humble career. And if you'd like, I'll mention several of the characteristics of the gun that made it innovative and made it so appealing to militaries, police, and then later to civilians.
Absolutely. And also just distinguish between a pistol and a revolver.
Sure thing. A revolver has a cylinder that holds the ammunition that moves in a circular fashion. Each time you pull the trigger, the hammer falls, firing pin hits the back of the cartridge, and that initiates the explosion and release of gas and the propulsion of the bullet out the front of the barrel. In contrast, a pistol does not have a revolving cylinder. It has an ammunition magazine, a rectangular spring-loaded box that snaps into the bottom of the grip with the ammunition stacked up, one bullet on top of another. And the pulling of the trigger initiates a process whereby the mechanism on the top of the gun, the so-called slide, shifts position, scoops up a round from the top of the magazine and puts it into the firing chamber so that it's ready to be fired when the firing pin hits it in back. So it's two different technologies for propelling a round out the barrel. And they're quite different, and both designs have been around for a long time. What Glock did is he took the pistol design and he took it to a new level. He, with the advice of his expert buddies, he employed industrial strength plastic, or sometimes referred to as polymer, to build the bottom part or the receiver of the handgun. This allowed him to make it much lighter. It created more room for the magazine so he could make the firearm have a larger ammunition capacity. The Glock, to be specific, had the original basic Glock had 17 rounds. Mm-hmm. And that compares to 8 or 10 rounds in a typical pistol and to only 5 or 6 rounds in a typical revolver. So you could see right there that the Glock had considerably more firepower. It was lighter. It was less susceptible to corrosion because it was the part that the hand touches was made out of plastic. It had a firing mechanism that had a very light trigger pull, which is a reference to the amount of force it takes with the index finger to engage the trigger and cause the gun to fire. The Glock, for example, the standard Glock has a trigger pull of about 5.5 pounds. In contrast, the Smith & Wesson revolver has a trigger pull of 12 pounds. So you can see that it's a lot easier to fire the Glock, and that translates into two things. One, it makes accidents easier. If you touch the trigger by mistake on the Glock, it's going to take much less pressure to shoot around into your leg or into your foot or God knows where else. Mm-hmm. And the professional football player Plaxico Burress and many others can tell you about the problems they've had with their Glocks shooting themselves. But on the positive side, it means that the gun is much easier to fire, so that if you use it properly, if you keep your finger outside the trigger guard and only put your finger on the trigger when you are ready to fire and destroy something, then you are much more likely to be accurate. And as the police found in this country, shooters who were mediocre shots would become competent shots, and people who were competent became excellent shots. And they had all this extra ammunition, which was seen as a great boon, at least if you're the good guys. I mean, of course, if the same firearm falls into the wrong hands, then the bad guys have more rounds to shoot.
Right, right. Now, how was the Glock introduced to the States?
Well, it kind of trickled over here through a couple of different mechanisms. There are people who, you know, spend their whole lives scouring the earth for the latest in firearms and write for various gun magazines, and the Glock got some attention that way, including in the famous or infamous, depending on one's perspective, Soldier Fortune magazine discovered the Glock and did a big, very laudatory article about it all the way back in 1984, and that got some attention in gun circles. The U.S. Secret Service, which is very interested in the latest in gun technology, learned about it and brought a couple of samples back in 1985. And around that same time, Gaston Glock realized, although he wasn't a particularly cosmopolitan man, or he didn't speak English and he didn't really know much about international marketing, but it did occur to him that if I'm going to make a fortune out of this, I have to get outside of Austria. And the biggest, richest gun market in the world by far is the United States. So he ended up hiring an Austrian-American English-speaking salesman, a guy who had been in the gun industry here for many years, and he happened to choose wisely. He chose a very vigorous, very imaginative guy who was really kind of the Johnny Appleseed, who took the Glock from police department to police department and showed them that this strange-looking plastic pistol really was a superior product. And it kind of took off almost like a fad. I mean, one police department would adopt it. The shooting instructor for that police department would tell the guy in the next county or the next state, hey, we've just adopted this strange thing called the Glock. You ought to take a look at it. And by the early 1990s, it was really replacing the Smith & Wesson all across the country.
Mm-hmm. And now, but it was controversial right out of the gate, right?
Oh, absolutely. It was controversial right from the start. And in fact, it looked at first like maybe the Glock would be kind of strangled in the crib, at least as a something that would be available to civilians, because gun control proponents were very hostile to it right from the get-go. Mm-hmm. However, this story turned out to have a very counterintuitive ending, and the controversy that came to surround the Glock actually benefited the company and helped make Gaston Glock the billionaire that he is today. Let me explain. The gun was opposed by gun control groups on a couple of grounds, but the main one was that because of its being made primarily from plastic, it would defy airport security. And in the mid and late 1980s, airplane hijackings were the main form of terrorism that people were focused on. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This was such a concern that the United States Congress convened hearings on the plastic pistol, by which they meant the Glock. That was the only one being offered on the market. And major jurisdictions, including New York City, where I lived, the five boroughs of New York, banned the Glock by name, by brand, which is very, very unusual. It'd be like banning a particular car by brand name. And again, the idea was that this was going to be, as the its opponents branded it, the hijacker special, that it would become favored only by the bad guys. There were rumors that Glock was selling his pistol to Muammar Gaddafi at that time, you know, the ultimate ruler of Libya and sort of public enemy number one in that era, the Osama bin Laden of his day. Mm-hmm. Then it turned out that a lot of this was just mythology. At the congressional hearings, rather than lighting their hair on fire, federal officials came up and testified to members of Congress that, no, we're not particularly concerned about the Glock. The airport technology of that era employed X-ray machines, and you can see a gun-shaped piece of plastic on an X-ray machine just as easily as you can see a gun-shaped piece of metal and wood. Mm-hmm. Moreover, for the gun-shaped piece of plastic to be dangerous, there has to be ammunition, and the ammunition is the same ammunition, whether it's a Smith & Wesson, a Sig Sauer, or a Glock. So that whole allegation literally fizzled away and was a tremendous embarrassment for the gun control movement and a tremendous victory for Glock. Here in New York, while the New York Police Department, which oversaw gun rules and still does today, was banning everyone from owning the Glock, it turned out there was a leak to the Associated Press, and it was discovered that the police commissioner himself, a man named Benjamin Ward, was carrying a Glock under his suit coat. So that's the gun that he chose to carry to keep himself safe, but no one else could have it. Well, the New York ban fell apart within a space of weeks. The New York Police Department, in its wisdom, announced that, no, it turns out the Glock is not unsafe. And within a few years, the New York Police Department, the largest municipal police department in the country, had itself adopted the Glock. So from there, the momentum was really just furious, and the popularity of the gun spread with tremendous speed.
Mm-hmm. And now, how did the gun consumer come to, I guess, learn about the Glock?
Yeah, well, a lot of people in this country, a lot of civilians who own guns, who would own a handgun for whatever reason, target shooting, protect themselves at home, used to be in the military and want to have a handgun, whatever, look, first of all, to their local police department to see what's new. So that's one way that civilians learned about it. Mm-hmm. Another way civilians learned about the Glock was through popular culture. Mm-hmm. Another tremendous serendipitous advantage that Glock had was that Hollywood glommed onto his weapon with tremendous enthusiasm. By 1990, in one of the most popular movies of that year, the second Die Hard movie starring Bruce Willis, the Bruce Willis character, one of the, you know, the great action heroes of the era, delivered a whole soliloquy in the movie to the Glock, rhapsodizing about its various qualities. Now, he actually got a lot of things wrong. He said the gun was made out of porcelain, that it was made in Germany as opposed to Austria and so forth. But none of that mattered. Here he was. Here is one of the most, you know, famous movie stars in the country, basically saying this is the cutting edge of firearm technology, and millions of people are going to see that movie. Word spreads even in the pre-internet era among gun aficionados. And that's all just reinforced when the hip-hop world basically simultaneously embraced the Glock. Mm-hmm. Again, for some of the same reasons. It has a kind of dark, glamorous, tough look. It's called the Glock, which is a word, a very staccato word that rhymes with cop and drop and a few other words that hip-hop artists like to throw around. And you had people as popular as Tupac Shakur devoting whole songs to the Glock. And then with tremendous irony and poignancy, Tupac Shakur himself was killed a few years later with a Glock in Las Vegas. So the gun, in a period of just a few years, really was everywhere. It was on the big screen. It was on radio and on people's CDs. It was on the hip of the police officers. Everywhere you looked, there it was.
Mm-hmm. And now, what was Glock Night at the Gold Club? That was pretty funny.
Yes. Well, one of the ways that Glock ingratiated itself with police departments was they had a very innovative and aggressive program whereby they brought the shooting instructors and procurement officers from various police departments down to Atlanta, where they opened their U.S. subsidiary. And they would bring them there for nominally for a training period where they would explain to them how the gun worked and how to service it and so forth. But the highlight of these four-day training sessions was an evening at the Gold Club, which was in the 1990s certainly Atlanta's premier gentlemen's club, to use a polite term. It was a high-end strip club. Mm-hmm. But it really had a national profile. For whatever reason that, you know, a place like that comes into vogue, the Gold Club was really popular with celebrities and with particularly with athletes. So you'd have a lot of NFL athletes, NBA athletes who would patronize the Gold Club. And then Glock, they were so frequent there and such a regular customer that Thursday nights were actually known as Glock Night at the Gold Club. And the Glock personnel would come over with 25 or 30 of these cops from around the country, many of whom, you know, it was a kind of a big deal to be away from home at all, let alone in the big city in Atlanta, let alone, you know, at a glitzy strip club where they're going to see, you know, their favorite NBA players saunter by. And so this was a very impressive, if not necessarily particularly upstanding, way of making an impression on these key consumers. And it was very much in keeping with how Glock promoted itself. It always walked this very interesting fine line between being the gun of law and order, the gun that the police carry to protect the innocent, and kind of the bad boy gun at the same time. And that having that dual appeal is one of the things that, that made the Glock unusual.
Got you. And they were able to take that same approach to gun shows and places like kind of out on the road, so to speak, right?
Oh, absolutely. They were very, very aggressive, and really to use the same strategy. The gun industry in this country has an annual convention called the SHOT Show, which stands for Shooting, Hunting, Outdoor Trade Show. It's often held in Las Vegas, and within a few years, the Glock party at the SHOT Show became the social highlight of the SHOT Show. I mean, Gaston Glock would pay the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders to come and do their thing at his show. So everyone wanted to be there. Even competitors, people who work for other companies, would try to, you know, snag a ticket, an invitation, so they could get into the Glock party. And the company, just through all of these various ways, developed an aura that, you know, kind of an intangible quality. Again, not necessarily a quality that you'd want to, you know, take home and talk to your wife about or talk to your mom about, but a quality that very much appealed to the people they were trying to sell guns to.
Okay. And now, how did that affect Gaston Glock himself?
Well, Gaston Glock went from being this pretty obscure guy to being an international business celebrity and ultimately a billionaire. Private jets. By the way, he's a pilot, so he even flew some of his own private jets. Mm-hmm. And he's suddenly jetting all around the world and rubbing elbows with movie stars who, you know, like Arnold Schwarzenegger, who use his guns, at least in a theatrical sense, in the movies. Mm-hmm. Schwarzenegger is a fellow Austrian, of course. He's meeting the Pope. He's being honored at the SHOT Show in Las Vegas. And I think it's fair to say that this kind of went to his head, and he became a fairly eccentric guy who was determined to do several things. One, to keep the money that he was making and not allow the tax man to take too much of it. And that prompted him to set up a very complex corporate structure with a lot of shell companies all around the world, moving his revenues around so that profits would be recognized in low tax jurisdictions as opposed to the United States or other high tax jurisdictions. That's not something unique to him, but he did it with an unusual degree of vigor, shall we say. He also had a series of fallings out with his top aides in 1999. And the best illustration of this was there was an attempt on his life, a serious assassination attempt that took place in a parking garage in Luxembourg. Mm-hmm. In the end, after a few years, the man arrested for masterminding this assassination attempt, this hit, was his top financial advisor, a Luxembourgian guy who is still in prison today, having been convicted of attempted murder. Glock was attacked by a hitman who bizarrely did not use a gun, but used a rubber mallet. The thinking being, what the police concluded was that they were trying to bash him on the head and then make it look like he had fallen down a flight of stairs in this parking garage. That was the plot. But Glock was a very tough old bird. He was 70 years old when this happened, and he basically fought his attacker to a draw before the police came and rescued him. So it was quite a story, and another indication of the kind of strangeness that came to surround this company in a lot of ways.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to, I don't know if you talked about this in the book, but when the gun itself was created by Glock, it was the socialist government of Austria was financed, right? Or sort of made.
That is correct. The government still was socialist. That's true.
Yeah. And so, but then he becomes this huge capitalist. Was that ever a source of conflict within Austria for Glock?
No, because his product became a tremendous source of national pride. The fact that countries, not just elsewhere in Europe, but the United States and countries around the world were adopting the gun, so that when the Iron Curtain fell and Austria came out from under the influence of the Soviet Union and the Soviet Union collapsed, he made a pretty smooth transition. I mean, he became, as you correctly point out, he became an industrialist under the old regime, and the extent of his wealth might have been somewhat limited if that old political regime had remained. But he had the good fortune of coming into most of his money in the 1990s, by which time Europe, and particularly Eastern Europe, was emerging from communism and socialism.
Mm-hmm. And now another question. So socialists get criticized for all the things they seem to not be able to invent or improve on. Blue jeans was one. I heard that most Soviet countries never were able to do well in cars too, but the AK-47 was created in the Soviet Union and
yes.
The Glock. And why do people call the Glock the AK-47 of handguns?
Well, because like the AK-47, it is defined by its simplicity. Mm-hmm. The fact that it has very few moving parts, mm-hmm. it can operate even when it is not taken care of very diligently. In other words, if it gets a little dirty or a little gunky, it'll still continue to fire. And it's a very basic firearm, not a lot of bells and whistles. And for that reason, as you say, it has been compared to the AK-47. Although to be clear, the AK-47 has had a much bigger political and social influence all around the world than the Glock has. I mean, there have been millions and millions, tens and tens of millions of AK-47s and knockoff AK-47s manufactured all around the world. Gaston Glock has kept better hold on his intellectual property, and while the Glock has been very influential and many other gun companies have imitated his designs over time, it hasn't, you know, fueled revolutions and so forth the way the AK-47 has.
Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about some of the civilian Glock users you met in writing the book.
Yeah. Well, you know, this takes you to the point that big parts of this country are deeply enmeshed in what I think it's fair to call a gun culture, meaning that they see tremendous symbolic and cultural significance in firearms. They take the Second Amendment very seriously. They see guns as a representation of individualism and self-reliance. And the Glock, in a lot of ways, really exemplifies those values because it is a very sort of business-like, unfancy, get the job done, and in that sense, even though it's made in Austria, very American firearm. And so it has a lot of very enthusiastic fans. And like anything in a country this big, it has a lot of people who don't like it. There's an alternative earlier design pistol called the 1911, mm-hmm. Which is a sort of a generic design that's actually manufactured by a lot of different companies. And there are people who will argue with you all day about the merits of the 1911 over the Glock, and the 1911 looks better and so on and so forth. These are fairly esoteric debates, kind of like if you are going to argue with someone over whether you like a Corvette more than a Mustang. But the Glock definitely has a very loyal fan base in this country.
Mm-hmm. And now the 1911, is that an American-made gun?
Yes. The 1911, you know, originally made, manufactured widely by Colt. The reference is to the year it was introduced. It was adopted initially by the American military. And it is a larger and in some ways clunkier gun, but one that in terms of its aesthetics looks to some people's eyes more appealing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've used both firearms. They have their advantages and disadvantages. But at this point, calling something a 1911 would be almost like it's almost like calling something a convertible or something. I mean, it's a design that is employed by and used as a label by many, many manufacturers.
Talk about the mass shooting in Killeen, Texas.
In 1991, a madman drove a pickup truck through the plate glass front window of a cafe called Luby's in Killeen, Texas. He jumped out of the car and using two handguns, one of them a Glock, killed more than 20 people. At the time, it was the largest random mass shooting in U.S. history. This introduced the pattern of the Glock being used in such random mass shootings where people seemingly with a suicidal bent decide to take a lot of people out with them as they go. You know, I think it's been pretty well established that people with that horrific inclination choose the Glock for very much the same reason that other people choose the Glock. It's got a lot of firepower. You can get a lot of rounds off and do a lot of damage before you have to reload. And there have been a whole series of mass shootings in which the Glock has played a role, including the shooting in Tucson, Arizona, in the shopping mall where Representative Giffords was wounded, and the Aurora movie theater shooting where in Colorado where the bad guy had a Glock as well.
Yeah. What magazine size were they using? I think Gabby Giffords, was it one of the expanded magazines?
Yeah. Yes. The shooter in that case had a 30-round magazine.
Okay.
Which, it, just as a quick aside, is not something that any ordinary user would put in his gun, say, if you were going to carry it concealed. I mean, no police officer would put a 30-round magazine in the firearm because it sticks very awkwardly out of the bottom of the grip of the gun. And that, you know, that takes you to some very controversial issues having to do with gun control and why we do or don't allow people to manufacture and sell large magazines. And that's an interesting question. And the Glock has been part of that debate.
Yeah. What, just in talking to some of the gun users that you spoke with, I mean, from the book, a lot of them seem very rational, responsible people. What were their views on, say, a 30-round magazine for a handgun?
There are very few gun owners who would say that they feel that it's a day-to-day necessity to own an accoutrement like that. The reason why people resist regulation of magazines, or for that matter, any particular firearm or piece of gear, is more symbolic and political. Their view is that that the Second Amendment, and their reading, says, you know, that the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. What part of shall not be infringed do you not understand? And moreover, any gesture, any effort to tell them what type of gun they can or can't have is only the first step toward more aggressive policies that will ultimately culminate in confiscation of their firearms. This is an argument that's very difficult to counter because it relies on a slippery slope logic. That what you're proposing is not what you're really proposing. It's just a pretext for something else.
Yeah.
And this is part of the reason why this debate has the kind of the strange nature that it does.
Right. Describe the different markets for handguns. There's, I guess, the primary market, which is just stores or gun dealers. And then
guns are sold. Well, from the manufacturer, sells guns to wholesalers, to middlemen. The wholesalers sell them to retail outlets. This would range from, at one end of the spectrum, a mom-and-pop store, you know, Fred's Guns on Main Street, USA, all the way up to Walmart, or, you know, Dick's Sporting Goods or Cabela's, which are large general-purpose stores that retail all kinds of products, but also happen to sell firearms. And then there's a secondary market where individual gun owners sell and resell firearms that they've purchased, and they may do that at weekend gun shows or these days increasingly via the internet.
Mm-hmm. And so what, I guess, where exactly are we in regulating the secondary market for gun sales?
Right. I'm sorry, what's the question?
Oh, yeah. What kind of regulations are we seeing now in the secondary market for guns?
Well, there are a variety of regulations. If you're in the commercial gun business, you're supposed to have a license, which makes you which puts you under the supervision of the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearm Bureau. There are more than 50,000 people who hold those licenses, and again, those that would range from individuals who may sell firearms from their garage to Walmart. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of other people who buy and sell firearms who are not, quote, in the business, close quote, who are not commercial dealers, mm-hmm. Who don't categorize themselves that way. And under current law, you are allowed to buy and sell those firearms, you know, as long as you do it within your state, not across state lines, and you're not... there's no questions asked. The background check that applies to all licensed dealers doesn't apply to the unlicensed dealers, and that's a big source of the current controversy over whether gun laws ought to be tightened. A lot of people, including members of Congress, have advocated for applying the background check rule to all commercial gun sales,
right.
But that proposal just last week was defeated.
Right. Now, are there any gun organizations that support that kind of legislation? As far as you know.
Well, you know, the key fact is that the biggest, most potent organizations oppose it, the NRA, mm-hmm. And others in the gun rights movement. Mm-hmm. There are some smaller organizations. There's a group called the Independent Firearm Owners Association, mm-hmm. which is based in New Hampshire, run by a former NRA guy named Richard Feldman. Mm-hmm. That's very pro-gun, but in this current, most recent round of debate, endorsed comprehensive background checks with an exception for family members and friends. So there's some variety within gun-owning world, but the people who have the largest organizations and the most resources and the most influence are very attached to the idea that when people propose something like comprehensive background checks, it's really just a pretext for something else.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's true or not is almost beside the point, because it's an allegation you can't prove or disprove. And it has shown itself to be very, very potent in Washington, for better or for worse. At a state level, in many states, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Connecticut, New York, Colorado, Maryland, they've all shifted their gun laws in the wake of the massacre in Newtown, and I think we'll see some other states shift their gun laws as well. So we have a federal system, and you have different rules in different places.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your research, has the gun, I guess, lobby or the gun community always been this sort of, unable to change, or... You know, you understand the question?
There was a major shift in the gun debate in the late 1970s. The NRA on each side got much more politicized and took much more extreme positions, and then in the 1980s came to have much more influence in Washington. On the other side, the movement shifted in a different way, in that in the late 60s and much of the 1970s, gun controllers really wanted to ban all handguns in this country. And the fact that they had that position back then is frequently brought up by the NRA today, because they say, well, today you are asking for much more moderate restrictions, but we know what your real agenda is. So the gun control movement has actually, in a lot of ways, moderated its demands, while the pro-gun side has gotten more aggressive and more extreme. And the bottom line is that over the last dozen years, the gun debate has shifted very drastically in the favor of the pro-gun side. Some people think that's great. Some people think it's terrible. But that's the, sort of the that's the way things have gone.
Right. Tell the story of the municipalities trying to sue the gun industry. We saw that happen a few times, right?
In the late 1990s, cities and counties around the country got together with plaintiffs' lawyers who had sued the cigarette industry in the mid-90s, and they sued the gun industry en masse, Glock and other companies, on the theory that the gun companies should be held liable for the costs of gun violence in big cities. These would be the medical costs, emergency response costs, and the police costs connected to gun violence. This was very appealing to a lot of liberals. It seemed like a rough analogy to the claim that states had made about the tobacco industry, that the tobacco industry should be responsible for the massive health costs related to smoking-related illnesses. But the gun suits, unlike the tobacco suits, did not lead to a huge settlement, and in fact fizzled out. And they fizzled out for two reasons. One, the analogy was not ultimately perfect and not appealing to a lot of judges, because unlike in the situation with cigarettes, there's an intervening wrongdoer in the gun scenario. In order for the gun, for that product, to have a harmful effect, it has to be misused. If it's sitting inert in some lawful owner's gun safe in his closet, actually it's not imposing any additional costs on society. It becomes a problem when a criminal uses it or an insane person uses it, and so forth. And judges, when they looked at this theory, said to the plaintiffs, to the cities and counties, you're missing a step in your logic, and by leaving the trigger person out, by leaving the bad guy out, you're creating a chain of liability that I'm not going to enforce. A second reason the suits failed was that the NRA and local gun organizations persuaded state legislatures in 1999, 2000, 2001 to pass statutes that banned the lawsuits. So even whether or not the local judge was throwing the suit out on legal grounds, the legislature was stepping in between the lawsuit and the judge and saying, get out of the courtroom. We ban this as a statutory matter. And then in 2005, this so-called preemption movement had its major effect, which was that Congress passed a law in 2005, which President Bush signed, which banned such lawsuits all across the country. So right now, the upshot of all of that activity is that the gun companies are actually more shielded than they had been before.
Now, there was also the whole process by which Glock would sort of buy guns back from police departments.
Yes, Glock instituted a very creative and ultimately controversial program whereby they would give police departments big discounts on new Glocks if they would trade in their old firearms, whether they were revolvers or even the first generation Glocks that they had bought. Glock then basically resold those on the secondary market, and that made the transaction financially attractive to Glock, but it had the side effect of disseminating more guns, right, putting more guns on the market. So that's the reason that once people noticed that this was going on, it became very controversial in the mid and late 1990s.
Right, right. So I think one example you gave was New Orleans was trying to sue gun manufacturers, and yet they found that some of the guns that they had already traded back in were back on the streets in New Orleans. They were complicit. That was the argument.
Yeah, that was a situation where Glock kind of caught the city of New Orleans anyway in a position of being quite hypocritical. The city was saying, you, Glock, are creating a sort of a nightmare. You're polluting our streets with your guns. You're producing more guns than lawful buyers really need, and that's fueling crime. But then it turned out that the city of New Orleans was itself selling its own guns back to Glock, fully knowing that they would end up back on the street, and in fact had made an arrangement with Glock so that the New Orleans police guns would not be resold within the state of Louisiana. So they arranged so that it would be dumped on somebody else. And this undercut the righteousness that the city of New Orleans and other cities that were employing similar measures had in condemning the gun industry, because they were basically in the gun business too. Now, I'm going to have to wrap up with another question or two. So
sure, yeah.
What else can we talk about?
I guess one of my last questions would just be, what do you think is sort of, what kind of gun control would you say is reasonable at this point?
Oh, well, that's a big question. I would answer that by making a suggestion I've made in print, which is that I wonder whether the whole debate ought to be reconfigured. Mm-hmm. And we ought to look at it from the perspective of reducing crime, not arguing about who can own which guns. Mm-hmm. Debating who can own which guns at under what circumstances is really an indirect way of trying to control crime, trying to control the misuse of guns. Mm-hmm. I would suggest that a way to sort of break through the logjam on this issue is to go directly to the misuse of guns, mm-hmm. A form of conduct which is already illegal. It is already illegal in almost every case where a gun is used, just to use New York as an example, is used on the streets of New York. And, you know, anyone walking around with a gun likely is walking around with it illegally. Mm-hmm. So I think one question to ask is, how can we discourage people from walking around with guns illegally? Because that will make it less likely that people will be using guns illegally. And the interesting thing is that in cities like New York, and in fact most big cities in the country, gun crime has actually been going down, and going down sharply for 20 years. So while we still have tremendous excess of gun violence, no debating that, we have less of an excess. We have less of a problem than we used to have. So something is happening. And I would say I would refocus the debate on the question of what's happening, what's working, how can those law enforcement steps be reinforced and spread to other jurisdictions where perhaps there hasn't been as much progress in the last 20 years. And if there are a few specific steps that we might have previously categorized as gun control, but which can just as easily be categorized as keeping guns out of the hands of criminals. Mm-hmm. In other words, a question of access as opposed to a firearm type, then that should be part of the program. And I think, for example, comprehensive background checks are a very good illustration of that. That's a rule we already have in the books. There's very wide agreement that criminals and people adjudicated mentally ill should not be getting access to firearms. And that seems to me to be very much an adjunct to tough law enforcement that keeps that discourages people from walking around with guns illegally. Well, let's also make sure that they're discouraged from trying to acquire the guns illegally. And if you frame the background check initiative in that context, it comes across as much more a crime prevention measure than something that impinges on any law-abiding citizen's ability to possess a gun. And you know, sometimes context is important. And if the context is, we're really trying to protect the good people from the bad people, we're trying to make sure the bad people don't put their hands on firearms, any kind of firearms, you know, assault weapons to the smallest handgun, that we don't want the bad guys to touch any of them. That's an agenda, it seems to me, that could be sold more readily, perhaps, than the endless cultural warfare over what guns symbolize to law-abiding people.
Okay. What are you working on next, Paul?
My next book is coming out from Crown, which is a publisher of the Glock book, next year, and it concerns a 20-year legal fight over who's responsible for cleaning up the terrible oil pollution in the rainforest in northeastern Ecuador. In the Amazon in Ecuador, there's a huge oil production zone that was first exploited by Texaco, since then by many other companies, and there's been a lawsuit that was filed all the way back in 1993 on behalf of indigenous villagers and farmers whose environment has been sullied by this oil activity. And the legal fight is just a totally fascinating one, and brings to the surface the fact that while the oil companies may not have been as responsible as they should have been, there have been a lot of other parties who've not been as responsible as they should have been, including the government of Ecuador, and brings to the fore some of the very unsavory tactics that all sides have used in this endless legal war, while meanwhile no one has cleaned up the oil, and the Indians are still up to their ankles in crude oil.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It seems like a completely different
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Paul, thanks so much. Guys, you've been listening to New Books in Public Policy with Sean Hamilton, and our guest has been Paul Barrett. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
My great pleasure.
Yeah,
absolutely. Appreciate your interest.
Okay, thank you.